You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Thank you once again for tuning in to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal. I'm an assistant professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Today we have a special treat for you listeners. This is a special live episode of the podcast, although, of course, because it's a podcast, by the time you listen, it will no longer be live, although hopefully everyone in the room who's here will still be live. Who knows how that works. We are coming to you from the Ciceronian Society annual conference meeting. Josh, what is this? Conference. There we go. Annual conference. I will say that this is a society that is worth paying attention to, so if you listeners haven't heard of it, I'll encourage you to go and look it up online. Check out the journal, check out the website, check out the various and sundry things they're doing. It's cross-disciplinary, so there's always something interesting going on. With that, our panel today will be a discussion of a recent book about the politics of C.S. Lewis. And again, I'll leave the discussion, the introduction of that to Dr. Bowman. Following the panel, there will be a brief time of Q&A. For those of you asking questions, we'll have some kind of microphone for you to speak into. If you don't want your question broadcast, just ask it from where you're at. And then that'll be the signal to me as the editor to take it out. So I don't mind doing that. It's fine. If you want your question to be out there in public for posterity, that's also fine, too. Just come up and talk to whatever microphone we have available for you, and I'll include it. And I think that's all of the logistical points I've got. So with that, I will turn things over to Dr. Josh Bowman, shortly to be of Heidelberg University.
Thank you, Coyle, and thank you to the City of Man podcast for sharing a small piece of our annual conference with your listeners. The Ciceronian Society is an intellectual society dedicated to the examination of three core themes: tradition, place, and things divine. Things divine is a phrase taken from our namesake, Cicero. We are not a society, then, of Cicero studies, though papers on him are enthusiastically encouraged. We are a society committed to the scholarly engagement with the many and diverse topics related to our three themes. Drawing widely from the humanities and social sciences, we facilitate conferences like this one to share scholarship and enjoy conversation with scholars from across the country. To learn more about what we do, we encourage you to visit our website at ciceroniansociety.com. That's C-I-C-E-R-O-N-I-A-N society.com. Like us on Facebook and sign up for our newsletter. Future conferences may be coming to a campus or other location near you, and we hope you will join us. One of the joys of attending this conference is the opportunity to meet exceptional, like-minded scholars such as today's speaker, Micah Watson. Professor Watson is Associate Professor of Political Science at Calvin College and a native of the great Golden State of California, where he completed his undergraduate degree at UC Davis. He earned his MA degree in Church-State Studies at Baylor University in Waco, Texas, and holds an MA and doctorate degrees in politics from Princeton University. In 2010-2011, he, like our keynote speaker, John Wilsey, yesterday, served as the William E. Simon Visiting Fellow in Religion and Public Life in the James Madison Program at Princeton. Micah joined the faculty at Calvin College in the fall of 2015 and served as William Spielhoff Teacher Scholar Chair for the 2015-2016 and 2016-2017 school year. Dr. Watson's research agenda includes ongoing projects on John Locke, a co-authored book on the political thought of C.S. Lewis, on which he will speak today, and a collaborative effort with his political theory counterparts at Wheaton and Westmont to consider the possibility of an evangelical tradition of political thought. He has contributed several chapters to edited volumes and given talks at Villanova University, Berry College, Oxford University, Princeton University, George Fox University, and Faulkner University in 2015. Professor Watson's hobbies include basketball, long road trips, rooting for the Pac-12 despite the pain and suffering that entails, I'm so sorry, pretending to be a film critic, and pretending to sled run design? It's no pretending about it. He designs sled runs, or does design sleds. He'll have to explain that. Has nothing to do with C.S. Lewis, but that'll be great. He and his wife, Julie, have four daughters and a son: Abigail, Anastasia, Annika, Alexandra, and a son named John. Accompanied by their decidedly non-pacifist cats, the Watsons make their home in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And I would conclude by saying that he's also a good friend and an encouragement to young Christian scholars like myself. He'll be speaking on a giant and a champion regarding tradition, place, and things divine, C.S. Lewis and the Oxford Don's contribution to political theory. It is my pleasure to welcome Micah Watson to the Ciceronian Society.
Thank you very much, Josh, and thanks, Coyle, and thanks to the City of Man podcast. Thanks to all of you for being here. I'll start with something Lewis wrote in January 1940, in a letter to his brother. He says, "This week I've been reading an Elizabethan, Hall's Satires, As Dull as Ditchwater, and Cicero's De Legibus. The latter you might suppose to be rather a bromide, but it is perfectly delightful." He goes on to quote some of Cicero's writings. For example, "You see the house as it now is, rebuilt by the care of my father, who was an invalid and pretty well spent here, his whole life here among his books. But in this very spot in my grandfather's time, there was a little house in the old style, like the one Curius has down in the Sabine country, and in it I was born." Lewis writes, "This is perfectly delightful. It's in dialogue form, held out of doors. Isn't this nice?" He says, "It's all very ordinary and obvious, of course, but like Boswell, so full of sense and leisure and happiness. Does it occur to you that people have written of that sort of thing in almost all ages but our own? I begin to suspect that the world is divided not only into the happy and the unhappy, but into those who like happiness and those who, odd as it may seem, really don't." Which is to say, I think Lewis would feel quite at home in the Ciceronian Society, a place that is talking about and values tradition, place, and things divine. You could almost define what he is about in many of his books and writings as those things as well. And so I think he'd be quite pleased to know that we're having a conversation here about him today and the other conversations that went on yesterday and that will go on later today. Speaking of conversations, one of Lewis's earliest students and one of his first biographers was a man named George Sayer. And he tells about his first conversation with Lewis. He writes, "As I walked away from New Buildings," and Oxford's New Buildings, by the way, were completed in 1458, "I found the man that Lewis had called Toller's sitting on one of the stone steps in front of the arcade. 'How did you get on?' he asked. 'Oh, I think rather well. I think he will be a most interesting tutor to have.' 'Interesting?' 'Yes, he's certainly that,' said the man, who I later learned was J.R.R. Tolkien. 'You'll never get to the bottom of him.'" Well, Tolkien may as well have been speaking to all of us, as I don't think anybody is truly going to get to the bottom of C.S. Lewis. I certainly have not, but it is fun to try. When Lewis was 19, 100 years ago, this month, he was in the trenches in France as an infantryman. He writes to his father on March 5th, 1918, so almost exactly 100 years ago, "My dear Pappy, I have been living at such a rush since I left hospital that it needed this battle and your probable anxiety to make me write." He goes on to describe that he's just returned from a four-day march in which he got 4 hours of sleep and he's been up all night digging in a trench, and that's why he hasn't been writing as much. His next letter is in April, April 5th. April 16th, he actually gets wounded badly enough that it takes him out of the war. It would be hard for us to overstate the importance that Lewis's experience as a soldier in World War I played in his life. It's what got him into Oxford, in one sense, as Oxford at that time had a rather tough math requirement, and Lewis was terrible at math, something I find rather comforting. But after the war, Oxford waived the math requirements for veterans, and Lewis was in. The war also set up his rather unorthodox family and domestic situation for the next 35 years, as Lewis had made a deal with his war friend, Patty Moore. Each of them had a parent who was widowed, and they made the arrangement with each other. As either one of us didn't make it out of the war, the surviving friend would take care of the other's parent. And while Lewis was injured in the war, obviously he made it out, but Patty Moore did not. And so Lewis inherited Mrs. Moore, Patty Moore's mom, living with her and taking care of her until her death in January of 1951. Lewis did not write very much about his war experience, nor, if the conventional wisdom is to be believed, about what led to the war. But he experienced firsthand the failure of what led to the war, the failure of politics and of democracy. For the elements of politics are present in the First World War: power, authority, scarcity, injustice, insecurity, and a tragic failure to promote and protect a common vision of the good. Lewis knew very well, personally more than theoretically, the costs of what happens when things go wrong politically. So what I'd like to do with my remarks this morning is describe for you Lewis's concerns about democracy and why he was concerned that democracy may not have the resources to resist the various faces of totalitarianism that tempt unhealthy democracies. Lewis did write often enough about the usual totalitarian suspects, Nazism and communism, but when he considered politics, he was more concerned about democracy. Well, let me start off by addressing one, perhaps, objection or concern right off the bat, which is why would we listen to Lewis at all about politics? And in some ways, this is the burden of our book, to try and show that in some important senses, Lewis was a good political thinker we should listen to. But you might say, well, wasn't he just a writer of children's books, fairy tales? Don't we know that he was ignorant of politics? Didn't he himself say that he didn't like politics, and haven't some of those closest to him said the same? Well, there are really three, or at least three, different C.S. Lewis's. There is the imaginative literary fellow who wrote children's stories and science fiction and reimagined Greek mythology. And I suspect many of us in this room may have first encountered C.S. Lewis by way of four English school children who find their way into an enchanted world with a parcel-carrying faun, talking beavers, a white witch, and a majestic lion. There is also the Christian apologist and logical thinker C.S. Lewis, the author of Mere Christianity and Miracles and The Problem of Pain and The Abolition of Man, the founding president of the Oxford Socratic Club, and the debater who took on all comers to defend the faith. These are the two more famous versions of C.S. Lewis, but there is a third C.S. Lewis, and that is the professor and the scholar, the man who as a boy had written a review of Paradise Lost at age 10, who knew Latin, Greek, Italian, and French before he went to Oxford for college, the student who took a triple first at Oxford in Greats and English, degrees that included the study of political philosophy, which he actually later taught at Oxford. A student so accomplished that at that time it would have been seen as a delay or a demotion, a distraction for him to earn a PhD, and so he skipped that step and went straight into teaching and scholarship at Oxford, teaching scores of students and writing several in-the-weeds works of literary criticism. If you've ever been tempted to think of Lewis as a second-rate intellect or merely a children's author, ask yourself how accomplished a scholar needs to be for Cambridge University to create a chair in medieval and Renaissance studies just to steal that scholar away from Oxford University. We do well to listen to Lewis because of all the Lewises: the imaginative storyteller, the logical Christian apologist with a knack for making easier hard things to understand, and the accomplished and brilliant scholar who could so keenly observe our modern times, in part because he lived in, inhabited, the literature and philosophy of the classical and medieval eras. So what did Lewis have to say about democracy? Lewis believed the modern philosophical rejection of an objective morality rooted in human nature had led to widespread moral nihilism. One practical outworking of this collective moral nihilism was the turn to totalitarian government, Nazism, fascism, communism, in the mid-20th century. In the Western world, the principal rival to these forms of totalitarianism has been and remains liberal democracy. But Lewis often noted that liberal democracy is itself threatened by the same denial of objective moral principles. In a liberal democratic regime, moral nihilism tends towards a different form of totalitarianism, what Lewis called a benevolent scientific technocracy or bureaucracy, which destroys and damages mediating institutions such as the church and the family, and makes genuine freedom, which Lewis understood as a certain kind of virtuous life built on economic, cultural, and ecclesiastical independence, makes this genuine freedom difficult to achieve. This concern about an omnipotent scientific bureaucracy is the source of his description of the National Institute of Coordinated Experiments, the NICE, or NICE, in that hideous strength. And if you look, Google this, you'll actually find there is an NICE in the UK right now. It's the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence. I don't think the founders had read That Hideous Strength. The best life, or at least the richest and happiest life, Lewis thought, was one cultivated with a freeborn mind, a certain disposition of soul that was made possible by leisured wealth. Such a life, Lewis wrote, is no natural endowment of the animal man, but rather has always been the fine flower of the privileged class. In modern times, we have tried and succeeded to a large degree to make some limited amount of leisure and wealth available to all. This was, for Lewis, a good thing. Standards of living are higher. People live longer, eat better, work less, and travel more than any other generation in history. But there is a danger. We are not content with simply increasing standards of living across the board. In our democratic and scientific age, we also want to equalize resources and rid the world entirely of sickness, death, and hunger. Of course, as a Christian and a decent man, Lewis was in favor of healing sickness and fighting hunger. But he also recognized that the promise of doing so through the institutions of government rested on a claimed ability of the government to regulate and rationally plan various aspects of an increasingly complex international economy. Few, if any, have the requisite knowledge to do so, and Lewis maintained that the new oligarchy must more and more base its claims to plan on its claims to knowledge, end quote. In order to apply this knowledge, government officials demand more and more discretion and power. But the kind of technical knowledge claimed by those who would plan our economic and political orders offers no special insight into the enduring questions of government. What is the good of man and justice, and what things are worth having at what price? In the end, Lewis insisted, liberal democratic governments will be thrust back against the reality of human nature. The new leaders, invested with untrammeled power, will, quote, take charge of the destiny of others, but they will be simply men, none perfect, some greedy, cruel, and dishonest, end quote. This is the central problem as Lewis saw it. We have enormous material resources and technical knowledge, but we have not, because we cannot, overcome the problems and limitations of human nature. Lewis's warning was that technical knowledge gives no unique insight into the enduring questions of justice and the good life. And democracy can make things worse. Who better to voice Lewis's accusations than Lewis's famous accuser, Screwtape, the experienced senior demon of the Screwtape letters? Now, the etymological root of the Hebrew word Satan is wrapped up with accuser, and so we can turn to Screwtape for Lewis's indictments of democracy. Lewis wrote the original Screwtape letters in an English newspaper in 1941. It was first published in the United States in 1943, and it's the book that made Lewis famous over in the States, landed him on the cover of Time magazine on September 8, 1947, and it's the only book that Lewis did not enjoy writing. Lewis needed to write like we need to eat. He wrote every day, and it got an itch, but this book was not the case like that for him. He did not enjoy writing this book. Why? He found it dry and gritty going, because trying to get into the mindset of hell, from which the book is written, is, as it should be for a Christian, difficult and trying. So given that Lewis didn't enjoy writing Screwtape, it was perhaps a bit of a surprise to see Screwtape reappear in the Saturday Evening Post almost 20 years after the original Screwtape letters in 1959. What was so important that Lewis brought Screwtape out of retirement? Now, as you know, the Saturday Evening Post is a quintessentially American magazine, and Lewis chose it on purpose, for his target was American democracy, and more particularly, American education and American public schools. Lewis went back to Screwtape to voice his concerns with democracy's ill effects. Recall that Screwtape is speaking from the perspective of hell. His is a diabolical voice, and thus, when he praises democracy, it is not for good reasons. The first problem with democracy, from our point of view, is that its meaning is unclear and ambiguous. This is not a bug for Screwtape, this is a feature. In his 1959 toast, Screwtape lets his hellish audience in on two different ways of understanding and exploiting democracy. Advising his demons and tempters, he says, "Democracy is the word with which you must lead them by the nose. The corruption of human language makes it unnecessary to warn you that they should never be allowed to give this word a clear and definable meaning. It will never occur to them that democracy is properly the name of a political system, even a system of voting. You are to use the word as an incantation, if you like, purely for its selling power. And of course, it is connected with the political idea that men should be equally treated. You then make a stealthy transition in their minds from this political ideal to a factual belief that all men are equal. You can use the word democracy to sanction in their thought the most degrading and also the least enjoyable of all human feelings. The feeling, I mean, is, of course, that which prompts a man to say, "I'm as good as you," end quote. Now, we all know this feeling, do we not? We see it everywhere in an egalitarian society. This particular temptation for democratic societies was analyzed brilliantly by the French aristocrat Alexis de Tocqueville in his Democracy in America. If you want a less canonical illustration, you can watch the profound commentary on American culture, Pixar's The Incredibles, a story about a family of superheroes whose amazing gifts are squelched after Mr. Incredible is sued for saving someone's life, and they're forced to hide their gifts in a sort of witness protection program. The sequel, by the way, is coming soon. The trailer is out. I'm very excited about this. This "I'm as good as you" mentality is a problem because it reveals and breeds a hatred of superiority and excellence and virtue. It tempts us to resent those who may be better at something than us or more successful, however we define success. It's the difference between seeing someone drive by in a very nice car and thinking, "Hey, good for him, perhaps that will be me someday," and thinking, "Oh, how unfair, how privileged, how do I get him out of that car?" Now, it is here very important for me to avoid what Screwtape encourages his tempters to do. That is, I need to be clear, whereas Screwtape encourages cloudy language and thinking. Did you notice the two different meanings of democracy that Screwtape mentioned? There is the form of government, which elsewhere Lewis describes as voting, equal political rights, the value of the individual, rule of law, etc. And then there is the democratic mentality, or ethos, which says, "I am as good as you." Lewis's strongest indictments of democracy are not of government. When Lewis indicts democracy, he is mainly criticizing the democratic mentality. His concern is whether you can have one without the other, or if having a democratic government will always devolve into a democratic culture. Here I'll offer you four indictments of democratic culture from Lewis. Indictment number one, democracy ruins education. There are two problems with democratic education. The first is that we are not sure whether a democratic education is, one, an education that Democrats will like, or two, an education that will preserve democracy. Lewis says these are two different things. For the education that Democrats like is one that fears making less gifted students feel bad or left behind. And that means we hamstring our most gifted students, and we make our less academically gifted students think they are smarter than they are. Lewis writes about this in an essay called Democratic Education, noting that in England, subjects like Latin and mathematics are being phased out because they are seen as too elitist, and the less gifted students are coddled and treated as if they are as bright as everyone else. We turn their hobbies into subjects so that they too can get good grades, and we create a culture in which we think everyone needs to go to college. Everyone needs good grades, everyone needs a trophy, and the sort of dignified work that does not require higher learning, trades for example, are seen as somehow beneath us. The problem here is that we transform the good of legal equality, which demands that everyone gets a fair shot, into an equality of emotional affirmation of result, in which we are embarrassed by excellence, and we treat mediocrity as if it is merely different, or even creative. The problem is that education that democracies need requires excellence in science, in government, in medicine, in the arts, and Lewis insists that excellence is not democratic. The wrong kind of equality in education is lethal. He writes, "Equality has no place in the world of the mind. Beauty is not democratic. She reveals herself more to the few than to the many, more to the persistent and disciplined seekers than to the careless. Virtue is not democratic. She is achieved by those who pursue her more hotly than most men. Truth is not democratic. She demands special talents and special industry in those to whom she gives her favors. Political democracy is doomed if it tries to extend its demand for equality into these higher spheres. Ethical, intellectual, or aesthetic democracy is death," end quote. Lewis goes on to note that the country does not foster excellence in education will soon fall behind or worse to the countries that do cultivate excellence in those areas. The second problem with democratic education is that, not surprisingly, democratic societies tend to think they are the most evolved of all historical eras. We apply Darwin's theory about biology to the evolution of culture and governance. Liberal arts becomes less important. We don't study the ancients. After all, they had slaves. And as a result, the educated classes no longer study Plato or Aristotle or even Virgil or Horace or Cicero. They thus have a diminished set of values with which to compete with the values of what Lewis called modern industrial civilization. Lewis described this result as an isolated, time-bound provincialism, which cuts off each succeeding generation from the wisdom and folly of its forebears, leading to a myopic intellectual vision and no standards by which to judge contemporary thought. What follows is what Lewis referred to as chronological snobbery, which bodes ill for moral education, as it breeds contempt among the young for the wisdom of their elders and undercuts their ability to distinguish genuine and time-tested wisdom from passing fads and trivialities. So indictment number one is democracy destroys education. Indictment number two, we no longer know how to reason or think it's important to do so. If a democratic culture tends to erode education, then we should not be surprised that we moderns and we postmoderns have lost our faith in our capacity to reason. Reasoning well is not democratic. It is demanding and requires us to favor some ideas over others and to listen to some wise teachers instead of what may be happening to trend at any given moment. Lewis began what may be his most brilliant book, The Abolition of Man, by criticizing educational trends that taught children to emphasize feelings over reasons. While some Enlightenment figures may have overemphasized what reason can accomplish, we have gone too far the other way. Lewis observed that modern man has a general and unalarmed belief that reason is not a valid means of proving anything. Irrational causes rooted in subconscious desires or economic interests, or as we would now add, race and gender identities, these are the real origin of thought. Lewis wrote of modern man, exaggerating only a bit, that he, quote, accepts without dismay the conclusion that all our thoughts are invalid. The fallout of this shift for political discourse and for democracy in particular is significant. I would be remiss if I didn't mention what Alexander Hamilton says in the First Federalist Paper, that it has been frequently remarked it has been reserved to the people of this country by their conduct and example to decide the important question whether societies of men are really capable or not of establishing good government from reflection and choice, or whether they are forever destined to depend for their political constitutions on accident and force, end quote. This is still a live question, I suggest. Democratic citizens, in theory, are supposed to reflect and choose, but what are we reflecting on if not the nature of things external to our own feelings? We should offer each other reasons for this policy or law. If reasons are merely the cover for subjective feelings, because how do you argue with someone about how they feel? Why should we consider our neighbors to have good faith objections to our particular visions of the good life? Why agree to disagree agreeably when the democratic process does not go our way? Why not label and dismiss our political adversaries? It's much easier, more effective than engaging in an actual argument. If we believe the positions held by our fellow citizens are grounded entirely in sub-rational and often intractable characteristics, then attempting to persuade them with reason and evidence is hopeless. Lewis writes a little essay on this called Bulwerism, which I would recommend. He says that this is the dynamic thought of the 20th century, which is to explain the psychological reasons why your opponent is wrong rather than actually refute the arguments your opponent is making. All right, indictment number three, democracy tends to make the people infallible. Proletarianism was Lewis's term for what resulted from a particular form of democratic thinking that flatters the people without reservation. Having accepted the principle that government legitimacy requires the consent of the governed, democratic citizens have conflated their authority with political infallibility. As a result, the proletariat, quote, are self-satisfied to a degree perhaps beyond the self-satisfaction of any recorded aristocracy. They are convinced that whatever may be wrong with the world, it cannot be themselves, end quote. The customer is never wrong, and neither is the citizenry. Lewis noted that for apologetic and evangelistic efforts, this shift in class self-satisfaction puts God in the dock. Whereas early Christians, Jews, and pagans alike assumed there was something wrong with them, modern men and women do not share a sense of sin and therefore do not recognize their need for salvation. How to proclaim the good news when the bad news is not accepted. Moreover, the test God now needs to pass, what gets him out of the dock, is not whether Christian revelation about him is true, but whether belief in God is helpful or therapeutic to the individual. The political implications of this shift follow the religious implications. Democratic societies resist the notion that the people may be badly mistaken about particular policies, about their moral views, and this encourages a politics of flattery and obfuscation, encouraging politicians to avoid unpopular but necessary stands in order to stay in office. In addition, like the modern view of religion, politics becomes primarily about what the government can do for me or my particular interest group. What starts off as a legitimate belief in the sovereignty of the people can shift into a self-serving individualism that demands of both God and fellow citizens, "What have you done for me lately?" Ascertaining the truth about whether a particular tax policy promotes the common good for the nation becomes wholly secondary to whether I personally get a good break from that tax policy. Indictment number 4. We value practical know-how over enduring wisdom. This shift in religious and political thinking from "is it true and good in itself" to "what's in it for me" illustrates another change, and this is the emphasis on practicality rather than truth and wisdom for its own sake. We ask the philosophy or theology major, "What are you going to do with that?" A democratic education that has been watered down, one that abandons reason and flatters the people with infallibility, leads to a purely pragmatic approach to politics. And a pragmatic politics is almost exclusively concerned with technocratic means rather than principled ends for human beings individually and in community. Ends are assumed to be common, but in fact are expressed with elastic words or phrases that obscure rough edges, national interests, economic growth, American or British values. As our government gets larger and larger, paradoxically, our shared conception of what counts as a flourishing human life becomes increasingly fractured. It may make sense for our governments to focus on delivering what is only instrumental to the good life. But what if not only government, but our entire culture mistakes the instrumental good for the intrinsic? Think of Socrates' question to his fellow Athenians in the Apology. "Are you not ashamed to be chasing after wealth and power and popularity as opposed to the goodness and wisdom and truth that might reside in the good soul?" These are Lewis's indictments, then, of a democratic culture. It destroys education, banishes the rule of reason, mistakes the voice of the people for the voice of God, and emphasizes the practical and efficient over and against the good, the true, and the beautiful. Despite all these misgivings, however, Lewis was still a small D Democrat. He was a reluctant advocate of democracy in the governing sense, and he was so because he believed in the fall. He did not believe in democracy because he thought everyone so wise and good that they deserved to share in governing. He was not an egalitarian. Hierarchy had its proper place in modern life, but that place was not in the political realm. In a passage that jars our modern ears, Lewis agrees with Aristotle that some men are fit only to be slaves. Lewis denounces actual slavery only because he thought no men were fit to be masters. "If we had not fallen," Lewis wrote, "patriarchal monarchy would be the sole lawful government. But since we have learned to sin, as Lord Acton says, all power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. The fall has corrupted the hierarchy of our natural being such that no human being can be trusted with unchecked power over another." Hence the artificial need for equality and for democracy and rule of law and the consent of the governed, and even the social contract. Lewis does not deny that some men and women may be higher than others on some scale or another, but that's all the more reason not to endow them with the coercive power of the state. Lewis offers us, then, a warning about a people that might be so miseducated and poorly formed. Such a people will be ripe for manipulation. A Chicago journalist named Dan Tucker wrote to Lewis in 1959 about how he had heard Darwinian Julian Huxley at a conference in Chicago, and that Huxley had sounded exactly like the people Lewis had warned against in The Abolition of Man and depicted in the conclusion of a space trilogy in That Hideous Strength. Lewis wrote back to Tucker, and here's what he said. "Thank you for your most interesting letter of the third. The devil about trying to write satire nowadays is that reality constantly outstrips you." So that sounds trenchant today, doesn't it? "Ought we to be surprised at the approach of Scientocracy? In every age, those who wish to be our masters, if they have any sense, secure our obedience by offering deliverance from our dominant fear. When we fear wizards, the medicine man can rule a whole tribe. When we fear a stronger tribe, our best warrior becomes king. When all the world fears hell, the church becomes a theocracy. Give up your freedom and I will make you safe, is age after age the terrible offer. In England, the omnipotent welfare state has triumphed because it promised to free us from the fear of poverty. Mind you, the bargain is sometimes kept. A warrior king may really save a tribe from extinction. The welfare state, at a cost, has come nearer than any society ever did before to giving every man a square meal and a good house to eat it in. The fears from which Scientocracy offers to free us are rational ones. We shall fairly soon hopelessly overpopulate this planet, and that population will be as defective in quality as excessive in quantity. But we cannot trust these new masters any more than their predecessors. Do you see any solution? 100 years ago, we all thought the democracy was it. Neither you nor I probably think so now. It neither allows the ordinary man to control legislation nor qualifies him to do so. The real questions are settled in secret, and the newspapers keep us occupied with largely imaginary issues. And this is all the easier because democracy always in the end destroys education. It did so for you some time ago, and it's now doing so for us. See a speech of Screwtapes, which will soon appear in the Saturday Evening Post. I am, you see, at my wit's end on such matters. Only a power higher than man's can really find a way out. It's an extensive quote, but I think it gives you a sense of where Lewis is at towards the end of his life in terms of his political thinking. I'm wrapping up. We see in this letter the extent of Lewis's concern about democracy, but as government and as culture, as well as his distrust of those with power, we also see something very close to despair as to political solutions. I am, you see, at my wit's end on such matters. But I fear that this morning I've given you a fairly bleak appraisal of democracy, or at least Lewis's view of democracy. Does he offer any hope for renewal of healthy democracy and genuine community? Is there a healthy alternative version of Narnian politics? Is there a Narnia option to go along with the Benedict option? Insofar as we address these matters on a purely earthly level, I think the answer is no. Lewis wrote that a sick society must think much about politics as a sick man must think much about his digestion. And by that measure, ours is a sick society indeed. But notice how Lewis concludes his letter to Tucker. Only a power higher than man's can really find a way out. There is a hope, but hope is a theological, not a cardinal or natural or political virtue per se. For a more hopeful Lewis, we have to go back to an earlier Lewis, the Lewis who spoke so confidently about Christianity in the dark early days of the Second World War. This may be odd for me to say as a political science professor, but might we need to think about politics less, or at least proportionally less? Of course, we do need to think about actual politics. How to vote, how to address hunger, war, education, summits with North Korea. We need more students at our colleges and universities taking political science courses, and I'm not trying to poach here from professors from other disciplines. Perhaps we don't need to think less about politics, but better about politics. There is a deep irony to be found in Christians who look to government as the primary solution to what ails our society, whether they lean to the side that wants to make America great again or the side that proclaimed earlier, yes, we can. Either way, that some believers, Christian and others, look primarily to government for moral and cultural renewal reveals an internalization of the secularization they seek to reverse. I conclude with a more hopeful Lewis from his chapter on hope in Mere Christianity, where he says that looking forward to the next world is not escapism or pie in the sky or wishful thinking. Rather, Lewis writes, if you read history, you will find that the Christians who did most for the present world were just those who thought most of the next. The apostles themselves who set foot the conversion of the Roman Empire, the great men who built up the Middle Ages, the English evangelicals who abolished the slave trade, all left their mark on earth, precisely because their minds were occupied with heaven. It is since Christians have largely ceased to think of the other world that they have become so ineffective in this. Aim at heaven, and you'll get earth thrown in. Aim at earth, and you will get neither. Thank you.
I want to just start the conversation then in response to your talk and in some ways provoke you and maybe see if there is a more qualified version of some of these claims, at least to a point. My guess is that what I'm going to say is more in agreement with Lewis and yourself than disagreement. But the first thing I want to ask, we talk about the ad hominem fallacy and the elevation of feelings over reason. And that's clearly a problem, but I wonder if it's a misunderstanding or overstated. We reason by means of concepts, experience, and stuff we have in our, we'll call it a pre-rational imagination. So when in an argument, someone says, I feel X, Y, and Z, or rather than I think, it tells us something about the kind of animating imagination or mythos that informs their reason. Now, that's not encouraging or dismissing Lewis's argument, but shows why he would focus so much more later in life on allegory and fiction as more persuasive than essays. He didn't abandon reason, of course. He didn't abandon evidence. But he put it into a myth, in a sense, gave it a different context. And he did political philosophy in a way that we don't necessarily do it as much anymore. So I wonder if maybe while democracy, and at least this criticism of democracy in a way that elevates feelings over reason, as you were describing, it's not necessarily that, but that it's reasoning in a different way, and because it's animated by an imagination that is corrupted in one way or another. Just respond to that.
Yeah, so when Lewis was a teenager, he got a copy of George MacDonald's Fantasties, and he later said that it baptized his imagination. This was when Lewis was an atheist at the time, but Lewis had a left brain and a right brain, both of them outstanding. And his first work was poetry. He certainly did not give short shrift to imagination or to feelings. In fact, that's what makes him so mesmerizing for many of us, is you can go to books like Miracles and Abolition and get the straightforward kind of logic chopping approach, which some people find very persuasive. But if you don't, you can also read Perelandra, and you can read Perelandra, part of the Space Trilogy. You can read The Chronicles of Narnia. You can read Till We Have Faces, one of his favorite books, the remaking of the Cupid myth. So I think we'd have to distinguish between the importance of imagination and feelings, which Lewis would certainly include. He wrote his first book after becoming a Christian, The Pilgrim's Regress, which was an autobiographical account of how he became a Christian, told through this, you know, sort of ripoff of John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. And he says there that reason is the organ of truth, and imagination is the organ of meaning. I think that's I got that right, okay, or close to it. So they definitely work together. At the same time, I find when students say I feel it to be an abomination.
Yeah.
and they try and stamp it out in my classes, because it's not so much that feelings aren't supposed to be there, it's that they are supposed to be there under the guidance of reason. So Lewis is a Platonist on this and an Aristotelian on this, that there's the wisdom of the head allied with the properly trained emotions of the heart help control the appetites of the stomach, in this very Platonic tripart way of looking at the human being. The Abolition of Man starts off by critiquing the elevation of feelings to the exclusion of reason. Right. So on the one hand, we're not brains on a stick. My colleague Calvin Jamie Smith emphasized we're not just purely rational beings, we're just brains in a vat. But on the other hand, we're not just the emotive feeling as
right.
well. So those have to be together. They're both important, but they have to be ordered. If we want to find the truth of something, we don't trust our feelings, particularly if you come from the point of view that believes in a strong fall. Right. Our heart is deceptive. But reason's not infallible either. They have to work together with a community and with divine guidance. So I guess I would accept the comment, but I'd want to.
Now, talking about imagination and its relationship to reason brings up the topic of romanticism, which C.S. Lewis was in so many ways aromantic, I would say. Maybe not if there's a bad sense of romanticism, in a good sense, he was the good sense. But in terms of democracy and political theory, the name that comes to mind is Rousseau. And I'm wondering, I vaguely remember him appearing in your book, but where does Rousseau stand in relation to, is he kind of a paradigm of what Lewis is objecting to in democracy? Is it a Rousseauistic democracy that Lewis is objecting to?
Yeah, I think that's fair. So one of Lewis's biggest books is a book on, it's called The Oxford History of the English Language in the 16th Century, excluding drama. And for that book, Alan Jacobs tells us that Lewis read every book in the 16th century in the Bodleian Library at Oxford, which is a lot of books. And Rousseau comes in for some treatment there along with some other of the canonical thinkers. There are two ways I think that Rousseau would count as a bad guy for Lewis, even though Lewis is sympathetic with some of aspects of Romanticism. One is Rousseau, in his second discourse, in his origin story, his new creation, his account of where human beings come from, says that human beings have compassion for each other. We try to stay alive. He agrees with Hobbes and Locke about self-preservation. But we are perfectible. In other words, we are improvable, which means human nature can change, which means human nature is plastic, ultimately. And so Lewis calls him, in one sense, identifies Rousseau as a totalitarian, in the sense that he removes, you know, previous to that, political philosophy, whether Greek or Stoic or Christian or Jewish, was about what is reality and how do we conform ourselves to it. Once you have Rousseau and human nature becomes plastic and you more or less put God outside what's happening, then the project becomes creative rather than discerning. Now we can be what we'd like to be, and that's exactly what he critiques in Abolition of Man. And then Rousseau makes, you know, I think arguably the general will is infallible, it's indestructible. There he has these chapter headings in The Social Contract where he's describing the general will, and these are all qualities that previously Christian theologians had ascribed to God. Right, so within each Rousseauian society, this general will is itself holding all these almost divine attributes, which leads to idolatry. And Lewis was very hard on views that would elevate the state to a position where God should be.
Right. This is my last question, then we'll open it up to Q&A from the broader audience. At the conclusion, you talk about his fantastic quote, where you aim at heaven, you get earth thrown in. You aim at earth, you get neither, essentially. When we were talking about that and this focus on the next world and on enduring wisdom and principles, my inner, we'll call it my inner Eric Voegelin, that's a terrifying thought, but my inner Eric Voegelin kind of brings to mind the phrase immanentizing the eschaton, so that in a sense that by looking to the other world, is there a tendency or a temptation that Lewis may not recognize? Or maybe he does recognize it very well, that that by looking to the next world, we'll get impatient and want to make now heaven, to make now perfect. In a sense, he has to recognize this to a point, because the NICE, in that hideous strength, is a perfect example of what Voegelin called immanentizing the eschaton, trying to make heaven on earth here. And so he has to recognize this in some ways, but I wonder if in the one critique of democracy, but discouraging practicality in some ways, is he tempting us in that more dangerous direction? Because in one sense, practical reason or instrumental reason, being pragmatic, does it always have to be self-serving? Or can it be the means by which, or the primary means by which, we practice fidelity to these enduring principles, if that makes sense?
The practicality can be the primary. It can't be the primary any more than a car's engine can tell you where to go, right? It's going to help you get there, but it's not going to be the means by which we figure out where you want to get to.
That's the okay.
I think that Lewis does not think that practicality or instrumental means are bad. He doesn't think that feelings or romance is bad. Lewis is an Erastian, and also an Augustine. He's going to talk about the order.
Yeah.
They have to be in the right order. Every sin is some good thing that has been put out of order. So the problem with instrumental means and practicality is not those things in themselves. He knew that was important as well. Mm-hmm. But that when they have become the main thing, he has an essay called First and Second Things. Right?
There you go. Yeah.
When a second thing has displaced the first thing, that's when you get into big trouble. So he takes great pains to critique the notion that you can get heaven on earth right now.
Mm-hmm.
So I think when he's talking about Christians in the past who are more effective politically, it's because they got that order right. It's because that they wanted to serve God first. Seek first the kingdom of God, and all these things shall be added unto you. I think he's just fleshing out that main insight.
Mm-hmm.
And once you put those other things first, then the basic logic is you not only don't get heaven, you don't get those things either. It ruins those things.
Mm-hmm.
He talks about sometimes if you have two friends, if you go intend to have a great conversation, you're really not going to have one. If you're really interested in Cicero or Lewis or the Green Bay Packers, and that's what you're then. You get a great conversation out of it. But the great conversation for itself isn't going to get it. It's going to be something else you're focused on. So I think it's more of an ordering than a binary, this is bad sort of thing, and this is good.
That's a good example. Thank you.
So it occurs to me to wonder if there's a dissonance between Lewis's fiction and his nonfiction. I think there really is, and I wonder how deep it goes. His criticism of democracy seems to be generally modern. In fact, it sounds to me as an economist, a lot like Hayek's critiques of democracy and the role of knowledge in making it difficult. And Lewis says there, you know, are no men fit to be masters, even though there might be men who are fit to be slaves. But then in his fiction, it's infused with images of fit masters and the proper role of hierarchy. So he imagines what, in some sense, the proper structures of power ought to be. Could he even conceive of what a proper democracy looks like? And did he attempt it in any of his fiction? And is it possible that he's simply too much a modern, despite his status as a dinosaur, to go all the way in his nonfiction? And to really take the hard line that maybe democracy really is bad all the way down, and admit that, like the ancients, maybe there are men fit to be masters.
Can we clarify that? Is Lewis a monarchist, is what you're asking?
Well, yeah, that's what I'm wondering. Why isn't he? If his fiction seems to point that direction, but then in his nonfiction he insists that that's not the right way to go.
He's a monarchist in the Chronicles. So you do have monarchy in the Chronicles, and it works out fairly well. You also have a different world in the Chronicles. You still have a fall. He is not a monarchist. We do address this in the book. We raise the question, if Lewis was such a Platonist and Aristotelian, why is he something of a Lockean with his own politics? And I think that the straightforward answer is because of the fall and this kind of Lord Acton sort of idea and it's actually we see it in Aristotle. The best possible government is a virtuous one person in charge. And the worst form of government, the number one person who's virtuous in charge, and then there's a few people, and there's a virtuous democracy, different term for it. Then there's a bad democracy, a bad aristocracy, and the worst is the tyrant. And that's Aristotle saying that without a robust view of fallenness and original sin. But Lewis has that. So I think the short answer is he does not. Even if you find the virtuous king or queen, Till We Have Faces is all first person from a female leader ruling over a country. Secession is also tricky, right? And so Lewis knew his Bible. You did have some good kings in the Old Testament. But for the most part, you have 5, 6, 7, 8 bad ones in between the good ones because it's hard to raise good successors. So I'm not sure that there is as much of a discord between the fiction and the nonfiction. Out of the silent planet, you have hierarchy in the unfallen planets, right? So same thing with Perelandra. You have very much a hierarchical setup with the new Adam and Eve on Venus and with the Oyarsa, the angelic being who rules Mars. And they don't mind the hierarchy because they're not fallen. But when you look at that hideous strength set on Earth, on the silent planet, the silent because it's cut off from God and from God's angelic beings in the cosmos, then democracy is sort of a bulwark against demonic misuse of hierarchy. I'm blanking a little bit. We talk in the book a little bit about Lewis's treatment of this in his preface to Paradise Lost, and Milton's Satan, who goes up against God's hierarchy. And Lewis has some interesting things to say about that in terms of equality and politics. And so I guess I can recommend that to you and to anyone who's listening to check that out, both in the book and then in Lewis's Preface to Paradise Lost itself. I'd want to think more about whether there's a real discordant element between the fiction and the...
So I'd like to push on what I see as a bit of a false dichotomy here between monarchy and democracy, and try to figure out where Lewis's political thought would stand on questions like about constitutional level reforms that seek to limit the excesses of democracy. Right? It's not just everything is a direct democracy that's up for vote of all the people versus, okay, then you've got a dictator saying everything. So did he think that we were capable of designing institutions that would limit the worst excesses of democracy? When we say he's a small D Democrat, how would he feel about limiting the franchise in certain cases or moving moving a lot of the decision-making to institutions like the Supreme Court, which tried to decide issues on a constitutional level and remove the decision-making power out of the view of the masses. Right? Where does he fit on a spectrum of total democracy on one end of the continuum and total monarchy on the other end?
So that's a good question. He's not a believer in total democracy. He actually still is a supporter of the British monarchy. He supports it because he believes that we need to recognize nobility and people higher than ourselves. But he says the reason that the British monarchy can be healthy is because it doesn't actually have any political power. But it's still a reminder to us that we are not meant to live lives of flat equality. Equality is, he writes in an essay, like clothing or medicine. It's needed because of the fall. It's good, but not good in and of itself. No one wants to go to the hospital and stay there for a while. You go to the hospital to get out, right? And so in that sense, I think he would certainly support other arrangements apart from just a pure democracy. In fact, he's quite suspicious of just regular people. That's what he says. Democracy doesn't equip us. The theory is we're supposed to be active citizens, and the Greek ideal was that we were sitting around the market and discussing these things. Of course, that was only possible in some ways because they had another class of people making their leisured lives possible. I also have to say, you know, we wrote the book trying to make the case that Lewis was a political thinker, but it would be dishonest of me to say that Lewis was a detailed structures, institutions kind of thinking. He was not. So he did not have a lot to say about whether bicameral legislature would be the way to go. And so in that sense, I can't really give you much on that. He does have some advice for what Christians should do in a democratic society, and some institutional ideas. I do think if I presented it as if the choice is a stark one-person rule or just flat-out mass democracy where we're all voting on the internet, that's a false dichotomy. That would be exactly right. I think he'd be quite open to different places trying to figure out their own ways to allow people to have a voice but filter that through different institutions. Like in the United States, senators used to be elected by state legislatures. Non-democratic, right, but still democratic in one sense because ultimately the people do have authority. A Supreme Court that kind of decides things, I can't speak for Lewis on that, I speak for myself. That's just monarchy in robes, right? So I think he would have some objections to that, at least how that's become in some aspects of our own jurisprudence.
I'm wondering what you think Lewis would have made or what you might make of the statement of Lewis's contemporary Winston Churchill that democracy is the worst form of government except for every other form that has been tried. And when we're doing actual governments instead of ideal governments, then I recall Madison saying something like that, you can't control the causes of infection, but you can control the effects. Mm-hmm. So any response to Churchill on this one?
Yeah.
From either you or Lewis?
Yeah, I think Madison says in Federalist 10 that you can actually extinguish faction, but the cure is worse than the problem, right? You'd have to do it with complete control, and Lewis would have opposed that solution. So faction, you're stuck with factions, basically, and that's the evil you live with. I am trying to remember if Lewis directly responds to that Churchillian statement somewhere. I don't know. I think he would heartily agree.
Yeah.
I think that's exactly where he's at, that this is a terrible system. But it's working with material that we have, which is fallen human beings, and so in that sense, it does. And this is partly fits in with the American approach to government, which is it spreads out the power, at least in theory, such that the damage will be. When we have to choose between the potential to do great things or the potential not to do awful things, we side on that latter. This is what Tocqueville talks about, the democratic spirit, right? That we go for the comfortable and middling where people can have rights and enjoy a basic, decent life as opposed to trying to build the pyramids, which was built on the backs of pretty awful things. So I think Lewis would be pretty sympathetic with Churchill's statement about democracy being the worst, but better than all the rest.
So you mentioned earlier, I think if I heard you say it earlier, you're sort of suspicious of ordinary people and there's sort of some concern about questions of equality, but at the same time, Lewis is someone who's so fantastic, like the broadcast talks,
right,
at just, you know, kind of appealing at that level without kind of a condescension or anything like that. So, I mean, he does have an amazing ability to connect to the
yes.
ordinary.
No, that's a great point. Lewis very much loved regular people. He did talking tours and if he, you know, I said he's suspicious of the regular people. He's really suspicious of his fellow academics. So if you read that Hideous Strength, the beginning is this series of intrigues about this college and how awful it is and how it's really so to have more education is not, in Lewis's view, at all make you a better person. If you look at The Great Divorce, there's a scene where there's a great woman comes forward, and she has a train of attendants and animals behind her, and she is clearly, I think, probably the highest person that you encounter in heaven in The Great Divorce. And she's brought there to try and reach this soul from hell who's come up. And when Lewis talks to George MacDonald, his guide, he said, well, who was she? And he said, you would never have known her on Earth. Her name was Sarah Smith, perhaps, but she was not famous. But her household was one where everyone who came there was taken care of, and she loved her children, and she took care of animals and in her neighborhood. She's a saint. She's a great saint in heaven, right? She's a regular person on earth. So you're exactly right. Lewis, it was not so much that he's disparaging of regular folks. He doesn't think they're equipped to make political decisions. I think he's got something there. But he's also suspicious of elites. The other place where you'll see this is in the essay I mentioned called Democratic Education, where he says you need an elitist education. You need Latin, and don't think that that's going to leave poor Tommy behind. Poor Tommy, who's got bad scores and is sitting in back of the class whittling. Don't take whittling and make it its own subject to make him feel good. Tommy knows he's not smart. He's okay with that. He beats up the eggheads on the playground and beats them in sports. And he's the guy who's going to hold them accountable in a democracy, because the eggheads are the ones responsible for all our harebrained ideas. It's the regular Tommy folks who are going to say, that doesn't sound quite right. Which is why we see a reflection of this in our jury system. It's supposed to be regular folks trying to be a tether on all the lawyers and the experts. So yeah, great comment and point. Lewis definitely had faith in, loved regular people, saw them as better in many ways than his fellow elites, but didn't necessarily trust them to be in charge of political ideas.
So you laid out these various aspects of democratic culture, which Lewis finds problematic, and then you say he's just at wit's end as to what to do about this. So if you were to either extrapolate from his own thought or just your own thought, why do we have to be at wit's end, or what resources in Lewis do we have to overcome these defects, or are we just stuck at wit's end?
So I think what we've seen in the last couple years are these books from various thinkers that are outlining what Lewis was talking about back then. So Patrick Deneen's book, Archbishop Shuppett's book, Rod Dreher's book. And I mean, if you're asking me for like the 10 points to cultural renewal, I don't have that. I think Lewis is at his wit's end because he has been at that fault line where he grew up with certain things that were givens, and then he sees them disintegrating and is not sure what to make of that. And I think for some of us, particularly my parents' generation, particularly white Americans, they have had that same experience. They had certain givens where the culture and the government seemed to be on their side, and now we have no idea. Now there are women in men's bathrooms and vice versa, and you're telling me that I've got to pay for this and not that, and someone's getting fired. All these things are very... So I think ultimately Lewis, as a Christian, believes in hope, believes in God's sovereignty. I think ultimately, so myself speaking as a Christian, I believe in those things as well. How that's actually going to work out, because you can't just say, well, you know, let go and let God. We still need to do things and think about things, but how that works out. One of Lewis's big messages is you live, to his fellow British neighbors, you no longer live in a Christian culture. It's a post-Christian culture. And we need to think accordingly. And I think that's been one of the main themes from Dreher and Deneen and these folks is, and I think it's right. So I think that's something that we have to think about what that looks like, without at the same time just going to the hills, right? Not just for our own sake, but because the thing that my own view, that the core convictions we have about ethics and about sexuality, different things, are not only just to protect our own ability to say and believe those things, but because we actually think those are good for people. Right, it's actually good. It leads to a better life when those things are respected in a culture. So we don't disengage entirely. We still have to engage. We have to find different ways to engage. You can't assume we have this sort of Will Herberg, Protestant, Catholic, Jew sort of culture anymore. It's going to be quite different. Christianity's done pretty well historically when it hasn't been culturally dominant. There's a reason it became culturally dominant. And Lewis has a great quote somewhere where he says, "No wonder they hate us. Every time they thought they'd patted down the grave of Christianity, it's gotten back up again, starting with Jesus." Right? Mm-hmm. Everywhere where they thought, it's done, yet it springs back up in some way that even we as Christians, speaking of if people, everyone is, I'm not assuming everyone is a Christian, but from a Christian point of view, we would not have predicted. But if there is a God, if there is a Holy Spirit that's active, then we would expect there to be breakouts of activity and flourishing and healthiness, even amidst decay and going backwards and problematic things.
So, just as a final question, there's a funny meme that people share on Facebook, and that's our primary vehicle for political philosophy today, that says, I liked Christianity when it wasn't a political party. I remember, you speak about this in the book, and Lewis has, I believe, a shorter essay on this. Like, should we have a Christian party? Oh. Something like that. You remember that?
Yeah.
The relationship between partisanship and essentially Christian politics is something that he did directly address that I think is interesting. I wondered if you could reflect on that, or just that he provides an alternative to much of what has become of organized Christian politics in America.
Yeah, so there's a whole lot to say about that. I'll try to be brief. Lewis wrote an essay called A Meditation on the Third Commandment about Christian parties, and he explicitly rejects the notion. He riffs off an article by Maritain there, and he basically thinks that it's going to be idolatrous. And so I teach at Calvin College, which has a very strong Kuiperian vibe to it, and Kuiper, of course, started a Christian party. So we did a roundtable on this very question. The late Peter Lawler helped organize this. In the wake of the last election, should Christians be thinking about an alternative to Democratic and Republican parties in the United States? Lewis was very wary of that because a political party has to take positions on means to achieve ends. And on political means, Lewis believed, and I agree, that Christians can, in good faith, disagree about the best means to achieve ends. And when you label that party a Christian party, you are then giving the label of Christ's name to what cannot be universally held to be Christian, but is instead in this category of things that good Christians can disagree about. And so he thinks that you can't help but verge into idolatry there, in the sense that you're using God's name in a way that he did not intend by attaching it to particular tax policy, which is not explicitly given in Scripture, or a particular foreign policy that should be engaged in. And to put Christ's name on those things, Lewis found to be very problematic. And he also he looked at history there. How well has it worked out in the past when Christianity has identified itself with the actual means of how to achieve ends? He did think that there are Christian convictions that should be reflected in politics. And his solution to that was not that Christians should take the reins as Christians of political power, but that one idea was that it could create a Christian voter society. Now, how this would work would be where all the devil's in the details. But this Christian voter society would say, here are five things that are non-negotiable for us. If you want our support, then you need to line up on these things. And what that does is it makes the politicians come to you rather than you trying to exercise control over everyone else. That was his thought on that. He didn't develop it much. He did go so far as to say that he thought it might be binding on Christians, that for Christians who understand themselves to be under authority of their church should tell them, you need to, and the Catholic Church actually does some of this. Like Dick Durbin just got denied communion, or at least announced he would be denied communion by his bishop. And I think Lewis got to the point where he was at least open to something like that, where we would say, here's what we believe. We're not going to try and make you do it, but if you want our support, you will agree with us on these things.
Well, thank you, Micah. The Ciceronian Society is grateful to the City of Man for recording this podcast and for sharing this talk with the listeners. We encourage you again to visit our website, ciceroniansociety.com, like us on Facebook, and join our newsletter. And if you want to learn more about C.S. Lewis and politics, we encourage you to pick up C.S. Lewis and the Politics of Natural Law. With that, I will turn it over to Coyle, and thank you.
And thank all of you for your patience with these technological oddities. I know that this is an unusual way to do a panel, and I appreciate you being willing to play along. So thanks again to the Ciceronian Society for letting us record a podcast here. Thanks to Micah Watson, both for presenting and for writing such an excellent book. And I will echo that encouragement to go out and pick it up. It really is fantastic and well worth your time and attention. The City of Man podcast is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please feel free to drop us an email at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. Check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast. And please do stop in on iTunes and give us a review so that others can find the show as well. As always, thank you all for listening and for tuning in. Let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.